All right, welcome to it, another edition of the Disability Law Show. Good to have you here for the hopefully the entire hour. You can always send your questions to us, and that is 1-855-821-5900 to ask them verbally. Talk to Tamar and her team. Call that number. But the email is help@disabilityrights.ca. Tamar, we always start off with you on the show every week. You're talking about something, a case that relates to our overall topics, which we cover every week, every hour on the show. So what do you got cooking today?
Well, I'm all hot and bothered about a case that's coming up for mediation, so I wanted to talk about this because this is truly front of mind. And so for the benefit of our listeners, when we get involved in our legal claims for our clients, the real goal is to try and get a settlement for our clients. We want to shorten that duration from beginning to end, from starting that legal claim to the point where we get some compensation. And one of the ways that we do that most effectively is to pressure the insurer to attend what's called a mediation.
Yep.
This is a non-binding settlement meeting. There's no judge. It's not in a court. Typically it's done virtually. And we get together with the insurance company, their lawyer, their rep who has authority to settle these cases, our clients and ourselves. And in the process of doing this mediation, we will also prepare a fairly lengthy brief advocating on behalf of our clients, explaining to the insurance company where they went wrong. This is all the medical basis for, the disability claim. We'll talk to them about damages inevitably. There's a whole host of things that we do to leverage all of that information against the insurer to get a good result for our clients. And that typically will be a buyout of the policy for a period of time. So I am working on one of these claims, and I thought I would try and give our listeners a little bit of a highlight about my client's situation. I want to keep her confidentiality here, but on a general basis, I think this will resonate with a lot of our listeners because her profile is very similar to many cases that we deal with and many emails that we get questions on. And so she's in her 50s. She'd been working a very physical job for, 25 years. To her credit, she advanced quite a bit in her company and she was in a sort of a supervisory role. But she had an autoimmune health issue that had certain flares. So it like went away and it came back. And, she would manage it with pretty heavy duty medication. And then on top of that, once the pandemic hit, she started to develop other health conditions and obviously was more prone to potentially getting COVID if she was in the work setting. So she and her doctor decided to pull her out of the work setting, start the disability leave, try and get her flares under control and deal with some of the other health issues that she was having. But the profile is that she had a very physical job with a very physical-based disability. Those were the main considerations, at least out of the gate. And so she was approved and paid for the own occupation period of her policy, which is 2 years. The insurance company accepted that she was totally disabled from doing her physical job. But as insurers do, when the definition to continue to qualify for benefits changed, and when it became the requirement that, we had to demonstrate that she was totally disabled from doing any occupation, anything in the world for which she had the minimum education, training, experience, it was at that point that the insurance company cut her off and said, we think you can do, quote unquote, a sedentary job. So a job where she would be mostly sitting down. Here's the kicker though, John. She was approved and paid for those 2 years, had, I think, three adjusters up to the point where she was cut off. And the last adjuster who was assigned never contacted her before they sent the cutoff letter. Oh. So she went on with months, no contact from the insurance company. And all of a sudden she gets this letter in the mail out of the blue saying, we're cutting you off in 2 weeks because we, the change of definition is there and we think you can do something else. Very poor conduct on behalf of the insurance company. I'm all over it. This is going to be a good point of leverage when the mediation time comes. But in the context of that, it forced my client to basically start thinking about, oh my goodness, should I be returning back to work? What am I going to do now? And not surprisingly, develop some mental health conditions, some anxiety and so on around this whole process. So by the time she came to us, she'd actually tried an appeal herself. Wow. She had her doctor provide, helpful information, insurance company. Only during the appeal process had their own doctor do a medical review. Again, we talk about this a lot on our shows. Insurance companies will typically send your file to a doctor that they pay for to just look at the paper. They don't talk to you. They don't talk to your doctors. They just look at the paper and they give the insurance company answers to 3 or 4 or 5 questions about whether or not you can work. So they hadn't done that analysis at all before they cut her off, which they are required to legally, and only did it afterwards, sort of a woulda, coulda, shoulda, and not surprisingly ended up getting this sort of perfunctory review. This, like, you know, it was very brief, John. It was just terrible. And it made a bunch of assumptions. And one of the assumptions that were made in this process, to add another log on the fire, is that just because my client hadn't pursued full treatment after a procedure that she'd had, it must mean that she was okay. So just because she didn't get treatment, the assumption was she was fine and therefore should be able to sit and work 8 hours a day.
Right.
But I wanted to focus on that part of it because, you know, nothing could be further from the truth. You know, just because their doctor made these leaps of assumptions and that's what the insurance company ended up relying on to deny the claim doesn't mean that they are correct. So I don't want our listeners to ever accept what the insurance company is saying to them in writing, even in a phone call. These are claims that are absolutely challengeable. They are not valid denials. The insurance company didn't do the things that they should have done, didn't have a proper review. And this is where people need to assert their legal rights, John. They have to assert it. Otherwise, they're leaving so much compensation on the table and they're letting the insurance companies get away with it. And they shouldn't, right? When you don't have that medical basis, insurance companies know they're not going to go in front of a judge and justify what they did. This isn't a claim that's going to go to trial. They're going to want to settle this case. And I think there's going to be a premium for that settlement because of all of the things, and there's a whole host of other things, but a bunch of problems already with the way that they reviewed the claim. And so they are risk adverse, but yeah. We don't even get there. We don't even get to have that conversation, though, John, if people don't reach out and people don't take that step to actually fight for what they are owed when they are receiving these kinds of communications from the insurer saying, yeah, we think there's something else that you can do. And this was my client's situation. She actually toyed with the idea of potentially going back to work, even though her doctor, actually multiple doctors, were saying, no way. There is no way that you're working given your health and the progression of your health. And so, look, I'm pleased that we have the opportunity to advocate on our behalf, but I'm certain there's many, many of our listeners out there who are thinking, yeah, but, you know, I need the compensation, I need the money, or I don't know, and I got to do this and I got to do that. If the doctor is saying that you cannot work, that is a basis. Please, please let us assert your legal rights, or at the very least, just give us a call. Let's at least have a consultation. They're absolutely free. And then we can go from there in terms of deciding what the best path is for you.
Always good to take a step back and get educated from you, Tamar, for sure, or your team. And to do so, guys, just reach out, 1-855-821-5900, and the email address, which we're going to get into right now, anytime, help@disabilityrights.ca. Use it. Let's see who's up first today. Amanda says, this guy's worked for over 20 years at a bank branch. In the past 4 years or so, my health has been declining, and I've been diagnosed with fibromyalgia and vertigo. I've had periods of short-term disability leave before, but with work accommodation, I managed to get back to work. I'm 63 now, though, and my family doctor and rheumatologist put me off work again a few months ago. And I think this time it'll be for good. My disability insurer declined my short-term disability benefits, though I'm not sure why. My work manager has never been supportive of my disability, and I think she may be telling the insurer lies about me. Is there anything I can do to get my claim approved? Wow. Thanks a lot.
I really do not enjoy this part of the adjudication process, John, because I know that the insurance company will reach out to the employer, and they will ask them a series of questions as well as they are reviewing Amanda's claim. So they're not just going to look at the medical information. They are going to look to see what was happening in her work setting before she took that disability leave. And I fear, lie or otherwise, that perhaps her employer has said, look, we accommodated her for a while, right? And she managed to continue working with that accommodation. And if that's what the focus is for the insurance company, they're going to use that, unfortunately, against Amanda. They're going to say, look, well, you've had these conditions, you've managed to continue working. We don't think this is a disability issue. We think this is potentially a work issue. Oh. Now, it's not correct. You know, you can tell from the email that Amanda has provided to us is that she's no slob, right? I mean, she has worked for over 20 years at a bank. She has committed level of service. She obviously has some significant health issues, but those health issues, fibromyalgia and vertigo, they don't go away, right, John? They're conditions that get worse over time. So it's not surprising that she's now 63 and she and her doctors have decided, okay, enough's enough, you need to take a break. And there is some legal recognition of that too. There is law that says that you don't necessarily have to put yourself into a harmful situation, a situation that's going to set you back from a health perspective by working, just because the insurance company is, you know, putting up barriers and approving your disability claim. And so what's going to move the needle with Amanda? That's what she's asking. Look, is there anything I can do to get the claim approved? And I think that this is one where perhaps an explanation from her doctor medically of that progression, of her health issues, of the struggles, of why the decision was made now to put her off work completely. That may be what could be compelling and reshift the focus from the insurance adjuster, who's maybe looking at this and saying, this is all work related. You know, she's got a disconnect with her manager and, you know, this is an accommodation issue. Then the insurance company is forced, hopefully, to actually take a hard look at the medical basis for the disability claim and less so the work side of things. If they don't, of course, it's a prime basis for pursuing your legal rights, Amanda. This is not one that I would hesitate taking on, because her disability policy potentially pays her until she's 65 years old, right? So there's a couple of years there that are available for her from a disability perspective. And if the insurance company is going to continue to ignore that there's a valid disability claim here, then that is a problem for the insurance company. I know it's a barrier for Amanda right now, but there is a solution, and that solution is to reach out and start that process with our help.
And we'll take a short break. We got so much more to cover. We're just getting warmed up. Thank you, Amanda, by the way, for that email. You can always reach out by phone, which I'm sure is going to be a follow-up with Tamar. That number, 1-855-821-5900. And for you as well, you want to send an email along anytime, may appear in a future show. We'd love to have you contribute. Help at disabilityrights.ca. Brenda, you're up next. Stand by for that. And yours possibly as well, as we continue more of the Disability Law Show. Hang in there. You bet. Back to the Disability Law Show. Tamar Agopian, you want to reach out to Tamar. She is a lawyer we have on each week. And man, she knows her stuff. Just waiting for that phone call. And make it. Won't cost you anything just to have a chat, get some information. It might be as simple as that. You might carry on with Tamar and her team. That is all up to you, as always. But the number, 1-855-821-5900. Email help@disabilityrights.ca. Brenda, as promised, thank you so much in advance for this email and contributing to the show today. Says, I am a school administrator and went off work with anxiety and headaches last year. Before my LTD insurer declined my benefits, I was diagnosed with giant cell arteritis, which is an autoimmune disease. My doctors had told me this is what is responsible for my condition. I'm on prednisone, which is a steroid that is causing all kinds of side effects. However, my insurance company denied my claim because my doctors aren't treating me specifically for anxiety. If the diagnosis changed, does it still matter?
So I see a theme today, right, John, with these autoimmune conditions.
Yeah. And
it's not surprising. We've made a lot of advances in progressions in medical side of things. And so, medically, we're able to diagnose these things. And, there is some treatment measures available. And so what do you do in a situation like this? I think at the end of the day, what I'd like to see from Brenda's doctors is actually a very comprehensive review of all of the health issues. Anxiety and headaches in and of themselves can be disabling regardless of the autoimmune condition, right? And so that the symptoms around that, along with the symptoms that she's experiencing, the side effects from the prednisone, that's a really strong drug, John, really strong drug. And that drug in and of itself causes fatigue, nausea, weakness, vomiting. There's a whole host of things that come with that. And so, it's not an easy medication to take. And then on top of everything else, to try and deal with, other conditions like the anxiety and the headaches. The insurance company will look at all of it, though, or should look at the whole health profile. And I think that I'm concerned that perhaps the doctor was selective in what he or she put into the forms to support Brenda's disability claim. I'm not sure. I'd like to look at it and see. But it is important for there to be a medical basis for all of this and a treatment plan. you know, just because her own family doctor perhaps isn't treating the anxiety per se, doesn't mean that the condition isn't there, that the symptoms aren't there, and that there isn't a plan in place. You know, it could be that her doctor has referred her to a therapist. It could be that that wait time is very long. Could be that she was, you know, referred to a psychiatrist. We know, like, at least in Ontario, the wait times can be months before you get to see a doctor to actually have that diagnosis and that treatment plan in place. And so it becomes that much more important for your doctor to explain all of this in writing to the insurance company when the insurance company is reviewing the disability claim. Because if they don't have all of that information, or they cherry pick the information, that's, those are two different problems, right? If they don't have all of the information and they denied, well then, you know, perhaps it is one of those rare instances that further medical support might help the claim. On the other hand, if they have all of that information and they are still denying, then that's a problem for the insurance company. Then it's going to be the same advice I gave, you know, answering Amanda's email in our prior segment, which is, if the insurance company wants to bury their head in the sand and ignore certain key elements of your disability claim, then it's going to be on them when we start that legal claim to try and justify why they did what they did, right? The absence of action on the part of the insurance company is not appropriate, and they can't cherry pick information. The courts have said that, and they get their wrist slap if they do that. But I think that more to the point is that just because you have a change in the diagnosis, okay, that's what Brenda tells us. Look, my diagnosis changed, or the reasons why I'm off for disability has changed. Just because that has changed in the time that it's taking you to go from short-term to long-term doesn't mean that you're not entitled to disability benefits if your doctor is still supporting that you're totally disabled from performing your own occupation. In Brenda's case, that's a school administrator. So if the doctor's saying, look, you know, the anxiety, the headaches, the side effects from the medication, the autoimmune condition, one or all, it are causing her or preventing her from working, then she is absolutely entitled to disability benefits on that basis. And so I think, though, the pattern of that change perhaps is a little bit outside of the comprehension of adjusters who really, they just don't have any medical training, John. I mean, they don't have really much references. They Google things. That's the way they figure out, you know, what these conditions are, especially something like giant cell arteritis. I mean, it's a very specific condition, right? So if you have no understanding of that condition, the knee-jerk reaction is going to be no, right? That's what insurers do. They say no to otherwise valid disability claims.
And Brenda, we really hope that that helped out for sure. Again, email, sending them along anytime you got something. It's help@disabilityrights.ca. All right, tuck in. Let's get to Alex's emails. This guy's, my mom worked as a law clerk for years. She had to stop working almost 2 years ago because of chronic back pain, vertigo, and migraines. She tried to go back to work a few months last year, but could not manage. She's had lots of medical investigations and is getting treatment for all of her health issues, including now for anxiety. Her insurer recently asked her to keep a daily journal of her activities. She's also suspects that she and my dad were followed once when they were grocery shopping. She suspects that she's feeling very pressured and is worried her benefits are going to get cut off at the 2-year mark. Her doctors are supporting her, but is there anything else she can do? Sounds nice.
Alex, I can probably predict which insurance company this is.
No, come on. That's funny.
I swear, John, there is one that comes to mind that does this routinely. Okay. So folks, if you're listening, they will send you this activities log. They will ask you to complete the log, and they will send out an investigator to see what you're doing on the same days. And they will try and line up what you told them versus what their investigator told them that you were doing that day. So look, could it be that the benefits are going to end? Yes, Alex, it could be, unfortunately, okay? And so when you're trying to provide advice in a situation like this, I always say two things. Number one, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to hide. Don't worry about it. You provide open and honest answers to the insurance company, and if they send an investigator out, I mean, what are they going to see? Grocery shopping? Really? That's pretty basic stuff, right? I mean, you're allowed to go out of your house and get some food so that you can live and survive and still have a disability claim. It's not compelling, okay? It's not compelling if it's seen. It is compelling to the insurer, though, if you didn't tell them about it, okay? They get very hot and bothered about things that you don't tell them that you did, that they see you doing later. They shouldn't, John, they shouldn't, because The courts have a totally different view about surveillance, by the way. The courts generally will not consider it very persuasive, and looking at whether someone's disabled or even in personal injury claims, it's not very persuasive to a court. But we don't want it to get that far. We really don't want it to get that far. And so if there is some feeling that the insurance company is doing this, the only way really is to try and make sure that you're being open and honest and that your level of activity is endorsed by your doctors. So depending on what the health issues are, and I think Alex mentioned anxiety, for example.
Yep.
Anxiety is, you know, it's an interesting one because it is very different from person to person. And so the way that anxiety is being exhibited, the way his mom is experiencing it, is really what's key here. And so is it social anxiety? Is it anxiety for, you know, being out of the house? So is it like an agoraphobia where people cannot be around other people? If that's the case, then, you know, your mom being seen at a Costco, for example, that could be at odds, right? With saying I can't be around people and I can't talk to people. So you want to be careful about stuff like that. On the other hand, I've seen lots of people who suffer from anxiety whose therapists say to them, your homework is to go to the Costco. Your homework is exposure therapy, John, where they are encouraging their patients to put themselves in environments that are difficult for them, that are anxiety producing, in order to recover, right? To get through it, to this is part of the therapy. And so if that's well documented and that's part of the process, then the insurance company should benefit from that. They should have all of that information available to them so that they can do a complete review. Because the back end of this email tells us, look, the mom's coming up to the 2-year mark. We know at that point the insurance company is looking to see whether or not the disability is one that prevents, you know, Alex's mom from doing any occupation, anything for which she may have basic education, training, and experience to do, and a job that would pay her roughly what the LTD benefit pays her. So it's no longer her full salary. The insurance company intentionally reduces that threshold, the income threshold, to one that's usually about 2/3 of what you're actually making. So it's arguably a tougher test, much tougher test to meet past the 2-year mark to persuade the insurance company that the disability is ongoing, it's definitely disabling, I cannot work, and I cannot work in any setting, not just going back to my own job. And so these insurers will use whatever tactics they can to try and establish that they are in the right in cutting off the claim. Now, I also don't want our listeners to think, John, that this is a routine thing. Okay, people who are on disability shouldn't be paranoid that they're being watched every single day. And actually, if you think you're being followed, like, yeah, just be careful, because what if it's some creep out there and you
right,
need to get,
right.
you know, go to the police, right? Like, yeah. So I always worry about that for people. Generally, I find when insurers will do this kind of investigation, they will do it, yep, around the 2-year mark. Sometimes where we see it, maybe after a year. We see it when we've got subjective claims more often than not, but it's usually over 2 or 3 days. You know, it's not like someone's, you know, if the car is parked at the end of your street for a week, it's unlikely to be an investigator on behalf of the insurer. But it's also not one where you should be discouraged from engaging in any activity just because you think you're being followed. Many times we've been able to have successful outcomes on behalf of our clients, even when the insurance company has relied entirely on the surveillance to cut off the claim. So I have managed to successfully get, you know, results for my clients, even in those circumstances. But the key there is the open and honesty with the insurance company and the documentation around the level of activity and what's expected, because then there is no smoking gun, right? There isn't anything for the insurance company to look for and use against you, because you've been open and honest throughout the whole process.
Isn't it, they will try as much as they can, I guess, to glean something from the, if they bother to do surveillance tomorrow, will they not try to glean something? Because it's not cheap for them to do that. So they want to, you know, they want to get something out of it.
Well, money talks, right, for insurers, John, you know this, right? I mean, the way that their model works and they make record-breaking profits year after year is to collect premiums and pay out as little as possible. And so, yes, if they are spending money, you know, with an investigator, somebody out there doing this kind of surveillance, they're doing it assuming that they're going to find something that's going to help them close the claim early. that's really when you'll see insurance companies spending money on your file. It's similar to even the assessments that they do, the independent medical examinations that are not independent, right? The rehab facilities that they send you to for your benefit, but really it's for their benefit, right? To push you back to work, these kinds of tactics. And so surveillance is no different. But what I'm seeing more of a trend with, John, is not so much someone out there spying on you. They will do first a social media search. They will Google you. They will look for images. They will try and see what your friends have posted about you, or, you know, try and get that kind of information that's much more readily available now, right, than it ever was before. And so I think having a sort of a reasonable degree of caution in situations like this is helpful. Maybe you're not posting every second day. That might be, you know, like, I just think with people, you know, understand that it's a level of engagement. Maybe it's a good outlet. Maybe it's a way to manage your anxiety. I understand absolutely all of that, but it can be so easily misinterpreted by the insurance company and sort of taken out of context that I'd much prefer people sort of being a little bit more protective of their privacy than putting stuff out there into the internet world for the insurance company to sort of dissect.
Yeah, it's like we often said, you don't necessarily have to go dark for the duration, but just before you hit post or send or whatever, just, you know, go have a coffee, come back and go, should I throw that up there? Maybe not. Not that you're being dishonest, you just don't need the hassle down the road for sure. Okay. Want to take a short break and get into a few more of your emails with the remaining time here. Send one along, please. It may appear later today or on a future show for sure. help@disabilityrights.ca. You want to leapfrog that, go right for the phone call with Tamara and her team. Always invited to do so, encouraged. 1-855-821-5900. We continue momentarily with more of the Disability Law Show. Hang in there. You betcha. Disability Law Show continues. Tamar Agopian. Reach out to Tamar at Samfiru Tamark and stlawyers.ca anytime, or call 1-855-821-5900. Not a costly phone call, just to pick it up and talk to Tamar, one of her team, and just get some information, ask some questions. Not a problem at all. help@disabilityrights.ca, the email address used by so many every week, including Paul, who writes in, says, Tamar, my wife is 62 and has been getting disability benefits for 3 years now. She's in a union and she's eligible for an early pension, but it would be reduced. Her insurance company is telling her that they get to take a discount on what they are paying her for whatever she's entitled to get. This seems unfair to me. If this is true, it is essentially forcing her to retire early, which means her health benefits will end too. Why is the insurance company allowed to do that? Basically getting a credit for, I assume, some of her pension, no?
Yes. Paul, they're not really allowed to do that. So, John, I'm fuming. I'm sitting here fuming over this situation because, you know, we see this a lot, right? There are still people who have great pensions. Those pensions are available to them, you know, potentially when they turn 65. You know, they get it, unfortunately, into a poor health situation and they have to make some tough choices around what to do. And I just, the insurance companies, I'm rolling my eyes. John, there's law that says very clearly that if you access a pension that's reduced as a result of your disability, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's correct. In fact, it turns back to the insurer to say, well, you forced them into a reduced pension, your disability benefits should have continued throughout, okay? And that is the key decision here, right, for Paul and his wife. And look, we're not pension people, much like we're not tax people. So I always say to people, you want to get some clear advice around what to do when you access that pension. But it is helpful that he's reached out to ask us, well, what's going to happen with LTD if the insurance company is taking this position that they get a credit for it? Well, the policy reigns supreme. So my answer to Paul is, ask the adjuster, show me where in the policy it says that you get a credit for her reduced pension. Because oftentimes, once you access that pension, it's not necessarily defined in the policy. But you want to understand why the insurer is taking that position and if, in fact, their policy allows them to do it. And so let's get a little bit more into the weeds here, John. It's because there's a section in the policy that says, we will pay you X, usually 2/3 of your salary, if you meet the test of disability. Sounds to me like Paul's wife has already been getting disability benefits beyond the change of definition. Okay, so beyond the 2-year mark. So it must mean that they've already recognized that she's totally disabled from returning to any occupation. And so then they will be looking for other sources of income, right? They'll be saying, okay, Our policy pays her till she's 65. You know, we've got another 3 years here potentially. If medically she's not going to improve, then, you know, we want to see if we can get some credits for things. One of the big ones we always talk about is CPP disability. And like I said, oftentimes there's also a pension component or a pension credit in there. And so if there's eligibility for the early pension, certainly the policy will not say that you must apply for that early pension. The teachers have an unusual policy, John, so sometimes they have something in there around that. But let's leave those individuals aside for a moment, and let's just deal with Paul and his wife in particular. I'd be very surprised if the policy says that she has to access that early pension for the benefit of the insurance company. Because the other side of it is that once she's, if she's still obtaining the LTD benefit, she's, yes, getting her health benefits, which Paul has already noted to us, but she's potentially also getting a waiver for the pension contributions perhaps her employer is contributing. And so therefore, she may get a more fulsome pension at a higher amount if she stays on disability and then continues to accrue that pension until it's to its full value. So it absolutely is unfair for the insurance company to say in a vacuum that, you know, she has to access her pension and we get full credit for that. They're not dumb people, these insurers, John. They know that the pension amount, right, is typically far greater than the LTD amount. So it's going to wipe out their exposure and they're going to be able to, you know, close the books on Paul and his wife on the ongoing entitlement to disability benefits. I don't want to see that happen. Nobody in my team would like to see that happen. And this is one that insurers, I think, play a little fast and loose and take advantage of claimants who have good pensions to suggest to them this is their only option, when in fact, there are other ways to look at this and other ways to assert your rights on these kinds of issues.
The knives are out when it comes to these types of claims and pensions, for sure. Want to get to a search down for a, we got 2 minutes left, so I want to get to a shorter email. Mario's okay. Says, guys, I've been on, been getting disability insurance for a bit over a year because of a back injury that will probably need surgery. It's been an issue for 15 years, but it's gotten progressively worse. My insurer is now pressuring me to apply for CPP disability benefits. But from what I gather, this won't actually get me any more money, even if I'm approved. Can I just ignore them? Don't you wish?
So I wouldn't ignore them, Mario. I mean, I think that there are some policies that say that you must apply for these kinds of benefits. And if you don't, that the insurance company gets to estimate the amount and take it off your LTD amount anyway. So similar to what I was saying about Paul and his wife's situation, there will be a section in the policy that comments on this. And CPP disability is a big credit, right? That's one that insurance companies will typically, sometimes it can cut the LTD benefit in half, right? If you're getting half the money from the government, right? This is a government-sponsored disability plan. But from where I'm sitting, I think the benefits for applying for CPP disability, frankly, outweigh the downsides. And I think that I wouldn't hesitate to recommend Mario to apply. And, you know, maybe you apply as well for the disability tax credit, reduce the taxability of the CPP amount, but better you're getting that ongoing income from the government and the disability insurer, then you're sort of left high and dry if the insurer cuts you off or estimates in any way, and you're not getting that compensation for the government. Because it can be a long process, Mario. It can take some months to apply and get approved. And so I would get that process going regardless, because it sounds like there's still some health issues on the horizon for you with some surgery and what have you. And you want to make sure that you've got that compensation in place for you so that you can remain off work as long as you need to and still getting some kind of income coming in from the government and or the disability insurer.
It's all a positive thing, Mario, so apply for sure. You can't go wrong. I'm going to take a short break, like a few minutes to go. And in the meantime, here's the phone number, not just during the show, but outside, 1-855-821-5900. Email address, help@disabilityrights.ca. We'll take a short break. This is the Disability Law Show. Welcome back, Disability Law Show. A few minutes to go. Tamar is the one you want to reach out to. All the knowledge right there. Great team with her. Phone number, anytime. Won't cost you a penny. 1-855-821-5900. Email we always go to is help@disabilityrights.ca. Where do we end off here, Tamar? With Jerry, I believe. Jerry says, my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer almost 2 years ago. Because it was so advanced, she stopped working right away and began receiving disability benefits. After 3 rounds of chemo, surgery, physiotherapy, and treatment of her anxiety, she was finally at a point where she and her medical team were talking about a gradual return to work within 6 months or so. As soon as the disability insurer got wind of that, they cut off her benefits. She had a stressful job as a marketing manager and was expected to be back at work within 2 weeks of the benefits being cut off. She was still not recovered and did not actually return to work. A few months later, her cancer came back, unfortunately, this time in her lungs. She's back in treatment and we're still not sure whether she will be fully recovered. Should she appeal the insurance decline of benefits? What do you think, Tamar?
No, Jerry, no, do not appeal. Do not appeal. Okay, and here's why. It's easy for me to say no, but it's the context in this email is so critical, and the context of the unfortunate cancer recurrence is also significant. Now, the appeal process, let's talk about this. This is the process that the insurance companies have created to keep you, you know, dealing with them, right? Instead of really coming out to one of us and hiring a lawyer and fighting this. They don't want us involved, right? Because they know they're going to have to get real if we're involved. Instead, they will ask you to go and get more medical information and provide us more medical information. And maybe we'll look at this again, right? And we will consider whether or not, you know, Jerry's wife is entitled to ongoing LTD. Even when they've made a premature cutoff, even when she has not returned back to work, even when she has further cancer, right? And there's a clear basis for her to potentially be under the recurrence provision under the policy. So, and I'm going to get to that in a moment, but just to keep talking a little bit about this appeal process, what the insurer is not sharing with you is that the process itself is not necessarily transparent. That it's not in the policy. They're not necessarily required to put a new adjuster on it or a fresh set of eyes. They're not necessarily required to do a medical review or have you assessed. They typically don't even call your doctors to see what's going on. This is purely driven by, can you justify to us why you should still be off? Provide us more medical information. We'll take a look at it. And if it's not vastly different than the information they already have, John, then there's zero incentive for them or impetus for them to change their mind and change the decision. Because they'd much prefer to resist this kind of a claim for fear that, you know, Jerry's wife's going to be on claim for a long time, right? And I think that the profile is there for the insurer to continue to resist in a situation like this. And it's unfortunate. They should be absolutely doing right by her and taking the stress away of the disability benefit, but they will not if they think that she's going to continue to struggle with her health. And so sadly, I don't think that the insurance companies give claimants a fair shake during the appeal process. And what it ends up doing is simply frustrating people, running down the clock. You know, it's very not clear what's happening. There's no time frames. They tell you you're required to respond to them in a certain period of time, but they're not bound by the same response times. So I've seen people sometimes appealing for like over a year. It's just a very, very terrible process with no guarantee of a successful outcome. And that's the key difference between that process and working with us. I don't want to say it's a guaranteed success, John, but we have a very high degree of success of settling our claims on behalf of our clients. I can think of a few cases, in fact, that are very similar to what Jerry has described, where the result has been very good for my clients in situations like this. And so I'd much prefer Jerry and his wife focus on her health and her recovery and allow me, myself, someone on my team to be fighting the insurance company for them and persuading them that they got this wrong right from the start. The fact that there was a premature cutoff as well, that's problematic. The fact that they haven't considered that she never actually went back to work, that there's been a recurrence of the health issues, all of that is hugely problematic. The exception to the advice that we do give on appeals, though, and you'll hear a few of us say this, is if there is something entirely new. If it's a totally new thing that the insurance company hasn't seen or hasn't reviewed, maybe in that narrow circumstance, I'd say, okay, send the medical note or medical report for that new information, and you might have some success with the insurance company. But barring that, I do not like the appeal process. And so this is where I'm going to talk about the recurrence part. The policy will have a section in it that says, you know, if you attempt a return to work, and your health issues prevent you from working again. And we paid you before, and if this happens within, say, 6 months of us paying you before, we'll allow you to come back on LTD. And you don't have to wait the waiting period. You don't have to wait 4 to 6 months to get back on claim. You can just get back on right away, and your benefits should theoretically kick back up again if you can demonstrate to us that your health has recurred and you have issues that prevent you from working.
Right.
But the recurrence clauses are really the areas where we see a lot of resistance from insurers. And this is why I don't like the appeal process, especially for Jerry and his wife, because once they've got you off, they do not want you back on claim. And they will put a lot of pressure on that recurrence aspect of it to deny the claim on various absurd reasons that they will come up with, because the idea that your claim has recurred suggests that it's going to be a long go, right? Your recovery wasn't quite completed. You were thinking about returning to work. That never happened, or it did happen, but a short period of time. That pattern goes against the model for insurers, which is to resolve these claims and get you off the books. And so it is prime for a legal claim for all of these reasons and then some. And one where I want to see people asserting their rights and then allowing themselves to focus on their recovery so that they're not having to deal with the nonsense the insurance company is throwing their way, whether it be a recurrence or a change of definition or appeal after appeal. This is why we're so well suited to deal with these kinds of claims.
There's so much involved too. I mean, this is why we always, we tell people it's, you know, we appreciate the emails, but don't let it stop there. Make that phone call, because you can get mired in confusion and the insurance company will keep you in that loop for a while. And if you've never been down this road, which most people don't daily go on disability benefits, so it's for a lot of people the first and only time they'll do this, man, it could be daunting, confusing, and scary, right?
Absolutely, which is why we try and set up our consultations free. Yeah. We try and give people lots of opportunity to talk to us. There's no pressure involved whatsoever. And the idea being that if you do retain us, we try and make it as easy as we can, John. I want to distinguish ourselves from what the insurance companies have put these poor people through. By the time they come to us, they are confused. They are exacerbated. Yeah. You know, they're just tired of all of it. And I think taking this one element away from people just in a huge burden lifted off their shoulders, and it does really allow the time they need to focus on their family, themselves, their health, and make the insurance company my problem.
And with that, we're going to close out another show. Appreciate Tamara. Awesome as always. And thank you for sending along your email. And you want to follow up with a phone call to Tamara and her team if you've just been listening or if we got to your email. Thank you for building the show for us every week. We love it. You can continue sending those along. help@disabilityrights.ca. The phone number to reach Tamara and the team, 1-855-821-5900. And for any other questions, you can ask online through this website. It's anonymous as well, called MyDisabilityQuestions.com. And we'll catch you next time on the Disability Law Show.